Hello, and welcome back to another episode of Open Floor. I'm Andrew Sharp, and on the other line, Ben Golliver. What's up, man?
Not too much, Andrew. It's NBA playoff season. I'm feeling fired up. And to celebrate, I helped this podcast take a quantum leap forward in professionalism today.
I'm really, really excited. We're just going to jump straight to the mailbag. We were going to do like a 30-minute playoff preview, but then we got so many questions that are basically about the playoffs that we're just going to sort of let the listeners guide us tonight. It's a Thursday night, 9 o'clock East Coast time, 6 o'clock West Coast time. Ben, you just had a bagel for dinner. I've got a couple Perriers here, and we've got time to just run through this.
Look, so we are popping bottles in celebration. Clearly, we are living the high life, podcasters.
We are popping Perriers, and we're ready for the playoffs. First question from Colin McCarthy. He says, I listen to you guys all the time and would love to send you questions for the Friday pod. However, Sharp never says where to send the questions to. I don't have Twitter, and I have been scouring the internet for a contact email for the pod, but have come up with Solomon Hill. Nothing. Please inform me where I should send my questions. All right, so yeah, we're kicking things off with a little procedural note.
Great news, Ben. Andrew. Great news. I did it. So your solution to this question when we were kind of talking this over and workshopping it was that you were going to basically force people like Colin to just get a Twitter account and harass us on that social media network the old-fashioned way. And I mean, really, I've been walking around a little bit slow all week because my DMs are just so overloaded. It's just like weighing me down. Like I can just feel it. So we needed a different solution here. Like bottom line, we can't force people to get Twitter. We're getting so many questions, it's almost become unmanageable on Twitter. And we're also getting a lot of Instagram DMs, which is a little bit weird as well. So, long story short, guess what I did? I made an email address for our podcast. This is revolutionary, never been done before in podcasting history. Everyone write this down. openfloormail@gmail.com. Very simple. openfloormail@gmail.com. It's M-A-I-L, not M-A-L-E. And if you send it to that address, it will come to me. It will come to Andrew. We'll both get it. And that's really now the best way to get a question on the mailbag.
Yeah. I feel like this is a big step for us. We are graduating from Twitter mentions and DMs. Although, feel free to still tweet at us and still DM Golliver. Whatever you want to do, basically. And it's true. I felt guilty. I was like, you know what? Your life is probably better without a Twitter account. So I don't want this pod to drag you down and drag you into the Twitter madness. So yeah, this is healthy. Let's all delete Twitter and we'll just pod and email and we can carry on that way.
I mean, let's be honest, for a podcast that has notable sponsors like ADT, Mack Weldon, who else? Like Mercedes-Benz, T-Mobile.
Don't forget HelloFresh.
HelloFresh. I mean, we have some heavy-hitting sponsors. I think the Department of Defense, a few others. We were really just expecting people to like shout their questions at us as we were walking down the street. I mean, we needed to step it up here. So we did our part. openfloormail@gmail.com. Go ahead and send the questions there. You will most likely get on next week's podcast.
Yeah, well, one other thing, I also think we're going to sort of start to weave in some of these questions as we go in the playoffs, because I feel like things are going to get hectic enough that who knows? There's not going to be like scheduled mailbags or even scheduled podcasts, depending on how things go. But anyways, let's dive in. First question, first actual question here from T-Mar. He says, I was shocked to hear that Andrew Sharp voted for Hillary. I thought he was a big fan of InfoWars. Just real quick, I don't even know what inspired that, but if I'm giving off Alex Jones vibes on this podcast, I will walk away right now.
You're kind of a nut, bro. I mean, like, it's undeniable. Like, people think you're like quirky and maybe a little too detached from reality kind of way sometimes.
Look, sometimes I'll lean into it, but there's a difference between like having a little fun and then suddenly you're getting compared to InfoWars. I'm not cool with that, but it is what it is. Anyways, T-Mar continues. I'm going to Vegas this weekend. I'm trying to make some futures bets. What first round series do you think will most likely end in an upset? What team in the East do you think has the best chance of upsetting the Cavs? I'll let you take this one.
Well, look, first of all, I don't condone gambling. I go to Las Vegas and I stay in a gym, air conditioned for 12 hours a day, watching basically minor league basketball instead of gambling or drinking or going to any of the fun places in the city. So yeah. With that out of the way, if I went to Vegas this weekend, I don't think I could resist betting on the Bulls to upset the Celtics. There's too much going on in this matchup. And here's the problem, because it's a gambler's fallacy, because you know deep down I kind of want that to happen because it validates all of my months of Danny Ainge criticism for not doing anything at the deadline. But let's look at the facts too, though. No playoff experience wins with this core. Isaiah Thomas admitted to you a few months ago that he didn't quite know how to win in the playoffs yet. Jimmy Butler, to me, is the best player in the series. If you look at the point differentials between Boston and Chicago, it's the closest gap we've seen in a 1-8 series since 2010 when the Lakers played the young upstart Thunder. So that's
okay,
closer.
Hold on.
That's closer than the Sixers upset of the Bulls. That's closer than the Grizzlies upset of the Spurs. And look, this is mostly a case against the Celtics, I realize, because it's very difficult to make a case for the Bulls when they had a terrible offseason, a terrible season, and a terrible trade deadline successively in a row, and they didn't make Jimmy Butler's life any easier. That being said, there is just something about this matchup. Like, is Boston ready for primetime? Is it going to blow up in their face that they got the one seed and have all the pressure? Is Jimmy Butler going to be able to maybe slow down Isaiah Thomas just enough if they put him in that defensive matchup and then just be too much for Boston's perimeter defenders? I'm not necessarily predicting it's going to happen, but I would have a very hard time not betting on it.
Okay. Let's take this piece by piece. First of all, I don't think there is just something about this matchup. You explained this to me earlier today, and I was flabbergasted that you were willing to put faith in the Bulls. And like, it hadn't even occurred to me that there was a possibility that the Bulls could pull this off, mostly because they have just been such a mess. Like, literally an hour before we went on to this podcast, a friend who is a Bulls fan emailed me a rant. We're going to get to that in a second. But I just don't get it. Like, beyond Jimmy Butler, there's just not a lot to like. I mean, maybe you got the like Rondo playoff revenge angle, but I mean, I'm not sure how far that's going to take you. I want to believe in Rondo, but I've been wrong about him for like 3 years now. So it's tough, man. I mean, I totally understand where you're coming from on the Celtics. Like, as a Wizards fan, I have been worried about the Celtics secretly for about a month now, and I've been quietly rooting for the Heat because I think the Celtics are vulnerable, particularly to teams that are good inside, and the Heat really could have screwed with them and really could have pushed them. I don't think the Bulls are that team, and I think you're putting a lot of this rests on the like point differential here, and I think you might be reading a little bit too much into it.
Well, look, here's the problem. You didn't answer his question. Is there an upset on the board that you're willing to feel better about suggesting he wager his hard-earned money on than the Bulls over the Celtics? Because look, we can always say the favorite. Look, bottom line, we can say the favorite's going to win every single one of these first round series. That's kind of how it goes in the NBA. I mean, they're best of seven series. I'm saying I think the best bet for an upset is Bulls over Celtics. Do you have a better bet?
Not really. Look, I'm sorry. I don't really. I can safely say that you're better off just lighting your money on fire than picking the Bulls. And part of that, look, if that helps jinx the Celtics into an upset, then I'm happy. Like, that's the goal. But I just don't really think it's going to happen. If you're looking for futures bets and what teams you can that might make sense to bet on in the East, I would feel pretty good about putting money on both the Raptors and the Wizards to make it out of the East, which scares me to say that out loud, but I'm sure that the odds are pretty solid for both teams. So it's just roll the dice. LeBron is not going to be invincible forever. That's all I'll say.
Yeah, I think I would probably lean on the Raptors for that one. but that even just hurts my brain to rationalize because you know how I feel about the Raptors. But I guess in their defense, they should have total command in their first round matchup. I would love to pick the Bucks to upset. I just don't see it. They would theoretically catch Cleveland before they're fully ramped up. And we saw, you know, a few years ago, like Chicago gave Cleveland a pretty good series in the second round before Cleveland kind of pulled things together. And then in terms of balance, lineup versatility, offense, defense combination, depth, and a certain degree of experience with this core as well, Toronto checks all those boxes. So could they grind and ugly their way into a finals trip? It's not impossible. Personally, I'd rather bet on Bulls over Celtics rather than Raptors over the East field, personally.
Yeah.
But I could see why that would be a reasonable bet.
I'm just assuming you're getting pretty good odds. But moving on here, the speaking of the Bulls rant, my friend Sean says, hey, mailbag question / personal rant. The Bulls making the playoffs in this fashion is the worst fucking thing to happen, right? Once again, Gar Pax gets to hide behind their meaningless streak of playoff appearances and keep the Wolves at bay, while D-Wade's golden parachute goes full sail, campaign stays light years away from the league, and Jimmy says, bye, boy. Is there a more hollow and infuriating franchise to root for? I'm just glad that we got a window into the soul of Bulls fans there. We've been over this. Like, I think the Bulls are quietly the most depressing team in the league, because at least some of the teams that are worse, well, actually, no, the Nets and the Magic are probably rock bottom. But like the Knicks, you at least have like a badge of pride where everyone around the league sort of like feels bad for you and jokes with you. And like same with the Sixers and even the Kings. But the Bulls are just respectable enough to be completely miserable.
Yeah, I have a pretty fun stat for you. So you remember when they traded half their rotation to get campaign at the trade deadline? And it was like, well, you only do this if he's going to be your point guard of the future, and you probably should get that going right now, right? Like, that was the rational take. Do you know how many assists the point guard of the future for Chicago had during his Bulls tenure after the trade deadline?
No.
15. Something tells me like 1.5 Rondo games probably isn't enough production for 2 months out of your point guard of the future if that's going to be a real winning trade for you. So like I said, they had a terrible offseason. They had a terrible season. They had a terrible trade deadline. They still have Jimmy Butler, and I trust him more than any individual player on the Celtics. And if this thing gets ugly and chippy, which it easily could, I would trust him to kind of keep his head together, keep his game together, grind out points. Execute late game offense. Again, I'm not saying they're going to upset, but that's where I would place my money.
Okay, but if you're a Bulls fan, do you even root for that at this point? Because it seems like wholesale change is the only thing that's going to really solve anything.
But look, the time to blow it up already passed. You know, it's passed multiple times. As soon as they signed Dwayne Wade, they lit the whole season on fire. So you might as well have fun with the playoff series victory. It's not like they're going to fire Gar Pax if they get swept here, right? Like, that's definitely not going to happen. They've already completely shown that they've, given those guys like a vote of confidence. And here is the real killer counter argument to everything I've been saying here, which is that basically Hoiberg versus Stevens is like... however you want to phrase it. I mean, like a squirt gun to a bazooka. I mean, that's where this whole thing could fall apart for Chicago.
I wasn't even going to bring up Hoiberg because I kind of feel bad for him. He seems like a good guy who's been thrown into like the worst fucking situation imaginable. And it's just really rough. And he's just in completely over his head. And it is what it is.
I've got what I want from this series. I've changed my mind. Okay, I don't even care if they upset. I just want a Jimmy Butler shade towards Fred Hoiberg like we got from LeBron to David Blatt a few years ago at that press conference.
Exactly.
I want that reenacted. I want Hoiberg to go out there and explain how he diagrammed this game-winning play, and then I want Jimmy Butler to come out and say, no, Fred didn't have anything to do with it. That's what I'm looking for. Very much in play.
Two more notes on the Bulls. I have no idea what it would take to get Gar Pax fired at this point. And the other thing is that campaign trade, it made no sense, but like just the specifics of the trade, I have no idea how they arrived at that final offer, because they threw in Taj Gibson, like Taj Gibson alone should have been enough for campaign. And then they also threw in Doug McDermott, who they had already given up like at least 3 first round picks for or something like that. And then they also threw in a second round pick. So I just don't understand what leverage Sam Presti had with campaign or what the Bulls thought he was going to be. But like that move alone should be fireable just because it represents such like a failure of imagination and logic.
You know, as you were explaining that trade just now, I had a picture of myself like stumbling through a dark hotel room trying to find the bathroom. And like the Taj Gibson part of the trade is like stubbing your foot on the bed. And then the Doug McDermott part is like banging your elbow on the wall as you like react to your stub toe. And then the draft pick part is like running straight into a closed door because the light's not on. Like that really was just a completely disastrous move. What were they thinking? And it's crazy it didn't kill their season. Like, how did that not kill their season? That's what I don't get.
Just to be clear, their season is pretty dead. They're not going to pull the upset.
How is this team going to beat the number one seed in the East?
All right, next question. Lewis, we already sort of touched on this, but my friend is convinced the Bucks are going to upset the Raptors. How do I convince him otherwise? I've already mentioned that the Bucks start Tony Snell and have been Keith Bogensing Thon Maker because they have bad big depth. I've also mentioned the Raptors' elite defense since the break and the Raptors' superior role players. He's still not convinced. Is he a lost cause or is he actually right and I'm crazy? Just to be clear, what does Keith Bogensing as a verb mean there? Do you know?
Not totally sure, but look, guys, you can't call in or email in and ask us to decide whether or not your friends are lost causes. Like, we're not going to be like these, like, we're not God here. We're not trying to play God and like cast these guys out to idiocy. Okay. Like let's dial some of these questions back.
I just really appreciate the Keith Bogans mention. I don't think the Bucks have a shot against the Raptors. For some reason, people around the basketball internet seem to think otherwise. Like I've seen like 4 or 5 different people say maybe the Bucks can pull this off. I mean, I don't totally get it. Am I missing something here?
Yeah, here's the case for the Bucks. Giannis could easily be the best player in the series. Playoff Giannis could be a complete revelation, breakthrough talent. They have been a lot better than their overall 82-game sample once Middleton's been in the lineup. If you have to go head-to-head against DeRozan, Middleton's basically the perfect guy in the East who's not like an all-star to do it. Lowry is kind of a question mark in terms of his health and also his fit with the new guys. Because remember, he hasn't logged a lot of minutes with PJ Tucker and Serge Ibaka. Like, I don't actually think that's going to be a problem. But if there was some sort of a friction there where like they're just not on the same page or in sync, there's lots of turnovers, maybe things get ugly. Maybe they don't feel involved enough on offense once Lowry's back taking lots of shots. I mean, that is one possible way the Raptors could splinter here in the first round. All of that being said, I don't see it. And I think probably the best case this guy should make to his friend who, okay, let's just be honest, his friend's a lost cause. I think the best case is to start with the GM and ask him, look, like what more do you want from your GM than Masai Ujiri in terms of how he made those moves at the midseason to put this team in position to withstand the Lowry injury and then really be ready, balanced and deep, like I just mentioned, to make a nice playoff push. Like if that doesn't get you excited compared to, you know, trading for Spencer Haas, you know, and like some of the things that Milwaukee was doing, like there's a big gap there between how Toronto's handled its business these last couple of years and how Milwaukee's handled its.
Yeah. Good answer. I think you're solid. I really am enjoying the Masai love that you've been throwing out there the past few weeks. This is going to play great when he gives like $250 million to Serge Ibaka and Kyle Lowry over the summer. And well, they're just locked into this team forever.
He was sitting behind me at the Hoop Summit, and he's got the greatest voice of all time. Like, if he wanted to do a podcast, bottom line, Masai Ujiri would have the number one podcast. He'd be higher than Serial and, you know, Pod Save the World and all that. He would be number one just based off the quality of his voice
alone.
Pod Save
the World. I talked to Masai for like 20 minutes at All-Star in New Orleans, and he was awesome. He was such a nice guy, had great stories about touring Africa like 20 years ago. So I'm very pro Masai after my time at All-Star. I'm glad we're on the same page here. All right, next question. From Spencer, let's talk Jazz clips. Which big three do you like better? The Clippers, CP3, Blake Griffin, DeAndre Jordan, or Utah, Rudy, Hayward, George Hill? So I really have no idea how this series is going to go. Part of me is worried about the Clippers and feels like this is going to end, and it's going to end really badly, and it's going to be dark. So maybe that comes against the Warriors, and maybe they're fine against the Jazz here. They finished the year pretty strong. And, you know, Utah, like, I'm not sure what to think about them either, because we haven't seen them really healthy, like, all year. I mean, they've been healthy for, like, a week at a time, and then someone else gets hurt. But they seem to be healthy now. So, like, you could convince me that Utah could really push them here, but I also could see the Clips winning in, like, five games. So,
yeah, I really think this is the Clippers series. Just to answer his question, I mean, in theory, like, if we're not talking just this playoff series, in theory, if you want to make the case that Rudy and Hayward have, you know, enough long-term ceiling that that's a better big three, I'll listen to that. But if we're talking short-term right here, right now, I'm going to take the Clippers big three for sure, because I think Chris has a strong advantage, especially now that he's back healthy and playing pretty well. Overhill, no question about it. And I think Blake is more of a mismatch issue for the Jazz than Hayward is for the Clippers. Now, I'm not Luke Mbamute's number one fan in the world. I mean, he's a limited player, but I think he's going to be able to stick with Hayward better in this series than anybody that Utah has to throw at Blake. I mean, Diaw is washed. Like, just, he is. Unfortunate. Like, I love, you know, all the coffee jokes and things that you explored last year with him. He's washed. Right. Trey Lyles doesn't have the trust of the front office. And when I was looking, the coaching staff, and when I was looking at, you know, Derek Favors and his return, I thought he looked good, not great. And I think, you know, you got to look great physically if you're going to kind of keep up with the Clippers front court, because they do put a lot of pressure on you. So to me, I'll take the Clippers big three for this series. I'll take the Clippers in this series. And I think what you're describing, you know, the other shoe dropping and chaos and all of that, there's plenty of time for that to happen in the second round against the Warriors. You know, the Warriors have a way of just completely getting inside of their brain, ripping all of their confidence. And here's why I say that. Mm-hmm. Whenever the Clippers are on national TV, always look for what the color commentator starts to say about them, because it's very clear that Doc Rivers kind of does some brainwashing sessions before the game to kind of get his message out.
And those little one-on-one meetings with the broadcasters.
Exactly. And their last game recently, Reggie Miller was doing it. I think it was Clippers versus Rockets. And Reggie was really playing the storyline so strong about how, well, you know, can we really call it a disappointing season if they lose to a team they're supposed to lose to in Golden State in the second round? That wouldn't be a disappointment. That's just what's supposed to happen. So clearly, Doc is already laying that groundwork in these meetings, which means it's in the back of his mind, which means it's in the back of his players' mind. So if I had to guess, I think Clippers are going to win the series in five or six. I think they're going to get swept by Golden State. And I think J.J. Redick is going to cash out big time. And I think Blake is a serious flight risk. That is basically this worst case scenario that you're describing, but it does involve beating the Jazz.
All right. Yeah. You sold me. I think that is probably how things will play out. The reason I am most interested in this series is, like, number one, until about 3 minutes ago, I had no idea how it was going to play out, but I think now I am pro Clippers, and think they can handle this. But I really, just looking ahead to the offseason, I want to see how good Blake is and whether he's, like, a potential franchise changer in terms of, like, because I do think he's going to leave, but I wonder at this point in his career whether he still has enough left to, like, create a new title contender if he went somewhere else. And the same questions apply to Gordon Hayward. Like, I was thinking about it today. I mean, if you're Boston, and you can sign Hayward and not have to sacrifice any assets versus trading, let's say they get the third pick in this draft, and they can trade that third pick for Jimmy Butler and like a couple other pieces. Let's say they have to throw in Jay Crowder. Which option do you choose?
Well, if I'm Boston, I sit on my hands and do nothing, because that's all they ever do. But to answer your question, I would take
your
Gordon Hayward.
Your hate is so real. I really appreciate it.
No, to answer your question, though, seriously, I would take Hayward, because, like you're saying, it doesn't involve parting with an asset to add a really, really good player.
I guess so. But when you're paying $130 million to some guy, like that, you can only pay so many like B plus players that much money before you're just a B plus team.
Yeah, but if you're Danny Ainge, you're totally willing to do that because you still love the Al Horford contract. So that's not a well, hang up.
That's what I'm saying. It's like you've already got Horford. You got to get the next one right. You can't pay that money to like basically if your big three is Al Horford, Gordon Hayward, and this is like a 31-year-old Al Horford, Gordon Hayward, and then Isaiah Thomas at $200 million, like that's not a great situation.
Yeah, it sounds like a team I'm picking against next year in the first round. But yeah. Look, a couple of things on Utah. Uh-huh. I think this series has a chance to be really chippy. I mean, remember Chris Paul and Gobert are kind of going back and forth with some talk. Gobert and DeAndre are both sort of like hack-a-shack type candidates. Utah has just been through the ringer in terms of injuries this season. They're not going to go down easily. I think they're going to put up a serious fight. We know the Clippers are always up to shenanigans. And the one thing I would say about Utah, this is actually the closest series in terms of point differential. So if people are looking for other upset picks, I mean, this is kind of the natural one. Mm-hmm. The Clippers fall apart immediately if either Blake or Chris, if anything happens to them. Like, they do not have the depth. They do not have, really any way to get around that. And we saw that happen in the middle of the Portland series last year where, you know, Blake just kind of can't go. And even before Chris went down, the team just looked totally different. So
Hold on. Just to be clear, if Chris Paul doesn't get hurt, the Clippers still win that series without Blake Griffin last year.
Most likely, but it's pretty close. I mean, that was a pretty shaky second half to that series, or I guess middle portion of that series, as Chris was sort of like in the process of going out. I don't know. I mean, it's close.
That's a little bit of a reckless claim, but we'll continue. Let's talk Jazz.
But either one of those guys going out totally changes the entire analysis that I just gave. That's my only point. It's like, okay, if there's some random hamstring injury, if Chris breaks a finger again, if there's some random wrist strain. I mean, these kinds of things have happened to the Clippers. They don't have a margin of error here. It's so close on paper that if we're going to give them this first round series victory, we're doing so under the assumption that they maintain good health, and that has been a problem.
Yeah, well, and basically what you're saying is that the Jazz are a lot better than the Blazers were last year.
I believe that for sure, and I also think that they're better suited to withstanding like bumps and bruises or a suspension or whatever it might be, just because their season's just been, you know, one giant mess of like, that's like the normal for them. But,
exactly.
So they're going to need some help, though. That's all I'm saying.
Okay. Quick, one more Jazz question. This is more Jazz talk than we've done all season long. Jordan says, had a question you might consider answering. I was wondering if Gordon Hayward does decide to leave Utah this summer, do you think Melo would be willing to waive his no trade clause to go to the Jazz? Could you see Carmelo getting pissed off enough to consider going to such a small market? The answer is a hard no on that one. I cannot imagine Carmelo trying to sell Lala on Salt Lake City. But
are you serious?
it's too bad that he has a no trade clause, because it would be great revenge for the Knicks to try to send him to, like, I can't think of a place that he would be less likely to enjoy than Utah.
I would love to see a sort of like a skit, like a Funny or Die skit where NBA All-Stars are asked to point out Utah on a map. I would love.
Well, you know, it actually would be a really entertaining, like, Lala had her reality show, and I never actually watched it. I would watch it if they had to move to Salt Lake City and just sort of like embrace the locals there.
Look, Utah is one of my favorite states. I think it's the most underrated tourist destination possibly in the entire world. I can't see Carmelo Anthony going there.
Look, I've never been there. I talked to Rodney Hood earlier in the season. He said it's an acquired taste, but eventually you come to like it. And I think that would be part of the appeal with the reality show. We'd see them sort of turn the corner together as a couple, and I don't know, it's something to think about. So maybe we could sell him on it, but anyways,
probably not. Let's go on to the next question.
Brian says, hoping you and Sharp might comment on this piece by Chris Thompson from Deadspin. It's an article about John Wall and how he sort of belongs in the MVP conversation. After it hit, he writes, I expected some commentary and hoped for a 40 ounce of love for Wall, one of my faves. Alas, I've heard nothing. Felt it was great insight, and I listened to everyone. Can you guys show some love? Look, Wall was awesome this year. Beal was awesome this year. To be honest with you, I've taken like a 1 month break from the Wizards to prepare for the emotional journey that we're about to go on. Shit's about to get real, and the current version of the Wiz is good enough to make me paranoid about screwing it up. I don't want to talk too much about it. I don't want to think too much about it. But to answer the question, I think Beal and Wall are much better than the league realizes. Like, wherever you and Rob would rank both of them in a SI top 100 this summer, they are probably five spots higher than like what you believe.
Get out of here, dude. You don't think I've been on John Wall since he got arrested in high school and was one of the top prospects his junior year of high school. Get out of here with that stupid talk. Not only that, I mean, you got to get out of here, and Brian's got to get out of here too. I said he was number six on my MVP ballot.
That's
what more do you want? That's as high as it can go. He can't crack the top five this year. I'm sorry. I actually think the best part about, or one of the best parts about this East playoff bracket, is that we get a matchup between Wall and the world's most aggravating person in Dennis Schroeder in round one, because I want to see the full bloom of John Wall. We haven't quite ever gotten it. The closest we came, he got injured in the 2015 playoffs, and it was just a little bit cut off premature. I want to see this be sort of the playoffs of John Wall, where he really finally breaks through and somebody finally decides to give him a shoe deal, and he kind of gets the recognition that he's been seeking for years, whether it's the snubs on USA Basketball or wherever else. I think that Schroeder is the perfect person to get him switched into sixth gear just right off the top. And I'm not saying he needs motivation, but what better way to get a guy who just wants to go up and down the court constantly, shove the ball down your throat going, than forcing him to play against Schroeder, who just everybody hates.
Yeah, I'm really excited. Sunday at 1 o'clock, it's going down. I mean, where are you at with Beal? Do you realize how good Beal is? Do you watch enough Wizards?
I love Beal. I told you I was mad he didn't get the most improved player a couple years ago because he didn't play well enough, and now he's in the mix this year, and it's like, okay, well, thanks for showing up. he is an underrated playoff performer. I'm not sure people remember this, but he's had some insane playoff games at a very, very young age. I remember looking back in terms of his averages, like how many times he was above 20 at a certain age, and it was kind of like Magic Johnson territory. So I think that the two of them are kind of hitting their stride at the right time. And I think that they have a real strong shot to make the conference finals. I mean, sort of whatever happens with Boston, that side of the bracket to me kind of should go through Washington. I don't love that team, but I think that when I'm making my picks, I think my Eastern Conference Finals pick is going to be Cavs over Wizards.
Okay. Interesting. It's hard for me to tell. Part of me is paranoid. I think that the Wizards and Celtics, the matchup is not necessarily as close as it sometimes seemed this year, because two of their closest games were without Avery Bradley, and they were just totally lost trying to guard Washington's perimeter guys. However, I mean, look, Beal has been averaging 25 a game for the last like 2 months. His numbers are compare pretty well with Kyrie in Cleveland. And I mean, he's just really, really solid. And his ability to generate points out of nowhere will be real valuable at the end of playoff games. And he, as much as Wall, is one of the reasons I'm just like secretly bullish on this team, kind of paranoid. And it's also pretty funny because like 5 months ago, I was lobbying for them to trade Beal as soon as they were legally allowed to and try to get Boogie. But now Boogie's flaming out in New Orleans, so maybe they can just sign him in 18 months and everything. We'll get to have our cake and eat it too.
Yeah, I think the one concern I have with Washington is there's sort of like a Clippers level lack of depth and a super reliance on their best five. One of those guys goes down, even if it's Markieff Morris or Gortat, the whole thing shifts very quickly. Even if you love their backcourt and expect huge things from their backcourt, I mean, the real power of this team is how well that starting unit plays together, how well they've stayed healthy together, and just the continuity factor that gets blown up. All bets are off.
And what's been interesting with the Wizards starting five is that, like, Otto, Markieff Morris, and Gortat have all sort of come back to earth over the last 2 or 3 months. But Wall and Beal have been so good that it hasn't necessarily mattered. Like, they've cranked it up a notch as everybody else has come back to earth. But, you know, we'll see. I feel good. They're going to be in the mix, like the second or third best player in every series. And in Atlanta, those are the two best players. Well, actually, Millsap.
Here's my thing with their lineup, though. Like, they played more than 1,300 minutes together this season. No other lineup in the league played more than 900 minutes together this season. So, basically, like,
look,
for them,
the Wizards did not get the memo about rest.
Yeah. So what I'm saying is, like, for them to get to 50 wins and have that, like, that great of luck in terms of their starting lineup and that big of a reliance, and then just the idea that if you even take off Gortat or one of these guys who has come back to earth, and you replace him with the Jason Smiths of the world, or the Bojans of the world, and you're saying, hey guys, like, now we need you to roll out there for 30 to 35 minutes, it is going to get ugly. It's really going to show in terms of their overall quality of play. So yeah. I guess what I'm saying is I'm crossing my fingers that their starting five can stay together and stay healthy this playoffs, because it has been a pretty good story, I think, in terms of how strong they pushed after their ugly start.
Yeah. One more question on the Wiz and the Cavs. This is from Will. He says, hey, Ben, longtime listener here with a conspiracy theory. I've been wondering if Rich Paul and company influenced the Cavs and Wiz dropping to 2-4. Watching the Wiz-Cavs game, I've noticed how close Wall is with LeBron, and Wall is a client of Rich's. What if they believe that the Wiz and Cavs is a better Eastern Conference Finals matchup for entertainment and for branding? This all seems a little nuts as I put it down, but I just can't help but wonder. Now, I know this is probably more up Sharp's alley than yours, but it was just easier sending a DM than five crazy tweets. So, now I understand the InfoWars thing.
Yeah, I was going to say, this was the lead headline on InfoWars Sports.
This really, really is so up my alley. There's not a single Rich Paul conspiracy theory that I won't buy into. I don't think it happened here, but I mean, look, the Cavs would have Andrew Wiggins if not for weird Rich Paul like politics. So I everything's in play. I fully expect the Cavs to also trade for Eric Bledsoe one day to play with LeBron. But I don't think Rich Paul has the power to like adjust the seating in the Eastern Conference.
I was going to say that shows a real like in this version of events, LeBron is the cockiest person to ever walk the planet. I'm going to willingly take a much tougher path to the finals just to do my buddy or my agent's buddy a solid and give him a little bit more shine. I mean, that is a truly impressively confident man. I don't
well,
see
and
it,
also,
but please keep all these conspiracies coming. This is good stuff.
Yeah. Yeah. Look, any conspiracy is welcome on this podcast. It would require like, I don't know if it's necessarily like strategic tanking as much as like point shaving from LeBron, because they blew like a 25 point lead against the Hawks in the second half. So I don't know. That would be above and beyond.
I just realized that the lead columnist for InfoWars Sports is definitely Tim Donaghy, and he probably has a theory about that Cavaliers loss to the Hawks.
Okay, thank you for bringing me back. I don't want to be in league with Tim Donaghy, so I'm back to normal now. Rich Paul did not rig the Eastern Conference playoff bracket. Jeremy asks, is Kyrie the most overrated player in the league? People keep calling him a top 20 talent, but he's about 0-328 without LeBron. What do you think?
I was going to say, I mean, everyone's really obsessed with this whole idea of like, can the Cavs flip the switch on defense, right? I mean, mm-hmm. To me, the guy who's like the ultimate coaster is Kyrie. It's not like his dribbling ability is going away. It's not like his three-point range is going away. It's not like he lacks confidence in clutch situations. If anyone is going to get bored over an 82-game season, it's going to be the guy who's phenomenally talented and playing alongside LeBron James, who's always going to take on more and more burden when his team's struggling, right? Like, I think Kyrie's kind of in this weird position where is almost like natural for him to just kind of chill through March and April. And so I think people are overcorrecting against Kyrie in the same way they're kind of overcorrecting against the Cavs as a team. I think he's going to have a real bounce back here now that the games actually matter. I think a lot of teams, especially the Pacers, are going to have trouble staying in front of him, keeping him out of the paint. And so to me, let's go a little bit easier on Kyrie. I do think, though, with that said, it was very interesting to me that we didn't mention him once for consideration for All-NBA. Like, we went down all three teams. I think we pretty much both named a fourth and a fifth team with guards because we were throwing out names like Damian Lillard, DeMar DeRozan, you know, Kyle Lowry, who was injured, and so forth. And we never mentioned Kyrie's name once. That's a little strange given that he did have a finals winning three-pointer last year, and he is on, you know, the most high-profile team in the Eastern Conference. So I kind of get where this guy's going. I just don't think he had the greatest 82-game season this year. But I do think, like, the bright lights are on. Kyrie's going to show up.
Interesting. Yeah, I mean, I think not mentioning him for the All-NBA teams just speaks to, like, the crazy depth that we had this year, and just especially in the backcourt. Like, there were probably 15 guys who you could have mentioned for guard spots. And so it is what it is. I actually don't think he's overrated because he kind of is on that fringe. Like, he's not in the Russ, Steph, CP3, John Wall category to me. And to a lot of people around the league, like, he doesn't get mentioned in those conversations, and he shouldn't. He's a really good one-on-one player who, with skills that can be super valuable, in a half court set in a playoff series. His numbers were pretty good this year, but I'm a Cavs skeptic because I'm a Kyrie skeptic. And I don't see him showing up. I guess I am on the opposite end of the spectrum from you. I don't see him showing up and coming through again this spring. I think he was in a zone that was every bit as crazy as what LeBron did in the finals last year. But I don't think that's going to happen again. I don't think he can replicate that. We'll see.
Let's check back after he eats up Jeff Teague on one ankle for three games, and we'll see.
Look, maybe that's a way. Maybe that will sort of help the Cavs get momentum, and they can just kind of roll through and get into a nice little rhythm here, because that's what happened last year, and that's totally on the table this year too. But I Kyrie's defense is bad, and he needs the ball on offense. I don't know.
Here's my thing with the Cleveland. All the focus has been on their defense. I understand that. That's like the nitpicking weakness to go after. Everybody's forgot about their offense. Their offensive efficiency is better than each of the last 10 NBA champions. Their offensive ceiling is significantly higher. I mean, we're talking two or three cuts above any of the other teams in the Eastern Conference, including Toronto.
Yeah,
they have the ability to go super small when they want to, surround LeBron with four shooters. They've got arguably the two best off the dribble threats in the East with LeBron and Kyrie. They will collapse your defense and put tons of pressure on the rim, and they'll make you pay for it. And that is how I'm framing this entire Eastern Conference. I'm looking at Cleveland as basically a team that takes and makes more three-pointers than Golden State, a team that's got, you know, like I said, two of the best off the dribble threats in the conference, if not the top two. And everybody else is going to have to adapt to that. And even if their defense is merely average, that's a tough ask for any of these second tier teams to slow down. And that's one reason why I've been getting a lot of emails and DMs saying, oh, you're out of step with what's actually happening on the court. Like, Cleveland's falling apart. And I understand that. But it's easier to kind of take a couple months off on defense and then crank it back up than it is to play offense at the level that they've consistently played offense at all season long. And that's why I still have faith in the Cavs.
Okay. Yeah. I mean, I wrote today that, like, Kyrie personifies the Cavs better than anybody because, like you said, disastrous on defense, but then so good, capable of being so good on offense that it doesn't matter. And I mean, when Kyrie is locked in, like, he's the most unguardable player in the league. And I should say that I was vocally skeptical on this podcast last year, halfway through the finals, and he could not have been proven more wrong over the final 10 days of that series. So we'll see. Do you have the energy to re-enter the MVP debate for a few minutes?
I did, but let's just go snorkeling. Let's not go scuba diving on it, okay? Let's just kind of dip our head below the surface. We don't need to spend 45 minutes down there, you know, looking around for sea urchins.
Okay, fair enough. We can just read a couple questions. Drew Larson says, 2 rebounds per game is better than 8 wins and 3 seeds. You got caught up in the narrative and checked your objectivity at the door. I cannot believe a grown adult told me that about the MVP race. all right, next question. Jerry Kuhn says, so Andrew Sharp doesn't have James Harden in his top 2 for MVP voting, yet he remains employed. Listen, man, I don't want to, I know Harden's your MVP pick, but it's really tough for me to buy into his case, like, as the number one guy. He's had a fantastic year, but however you want to value this, like, if the MVP is supposed to go to the most incredible, outstanding year, Russ wins. If it's the best player on the best team, like Steph, Kawhi, if it's the best player overall, LeBron, Harden is very good, and his season might win an MVP in other years, but let's just take it down a notch with the, like, victim rhetoric. And if anything, like Daryl Morey told me, I'm just trying to value winning in a society that's been taken over by AAU bozos, and that's why I had to put Kawhi number 2.
I mean, you're just going to cut off before you even read all these emails who call you an idiot. I was kind of enjoying that. I mean, we've got some more. Like, don't stop there. Keep going.
All right. First of all, I've heard from some supportive people as well about the Westbrook vote.
I'm sure you have. I know your parents both listen to the podcast and they're very proud of you.
Spike Eskin says, if you were ever skeptical about MVP voting, know that Andrew Sharp has a vote and is basing his vote on 3 games in the last 2 weeks. So Spike feels especially betrayed because I had a circle of people who I would vent to about Westbrook hype throughout the season. Spike was one of the people who I would seek out every now and then to talk about it. And look, for the people like Spike who refuse to acknowledge Westbrook's season purely out of spite, I respect it. And I identify a lot more with Westbrook skeptics than I do with, like, the Russ hive on the internet. Having said that, over the past few days, like, I'm more comfortable than ever with Westbrook as my MVP vote. The dude is MVP. He just is. It's not based on 3 games. It's an entire season of absurdity and 3 games over the last few weeks that just sort of push it over the top while everyone else was kind of leveling off. Like,
look, I already compared you to Jason Chaffetz on the last episode, and now I'm just picturing Spike as one of Chaffetz's, you know, completely underwhelmed and so sad constituents, you know, holding a sign up at one of his rallies saying, how could you let us down like this? Look, you flip-flopped hard, 100%. You've got to own that. You can't try to spin it like it's an 82-game award now after you were against Westbrook until basically 72 hours before the ballots were due, and you really just kind of wanted to argue with me and take a different tack
no.
than I took.
No, that's not it at all, okay? It's not a flip-flop if I change my mind. If anything, I've demonstrated...
Yeah, that's a flip-flop.
No, if anything, I've demonstrated more integrity by rising above my personal objections to some of the Russ worship to say, look, some of this is a little bit out of whack, but you can't deny that he has had just an incredible season. And don't talk to me about the narrative thing either, because the whole goddamn point of the award is to tell the story of the season. And Russ in OKC was by far the best story of the regular season. It's just like, I don't know. The more I think about it, the more I'm right about this.
Well, and I hear Drew. I mean, clearly you did not, you did not keep your objectivity. You checked it at the door. I hear Jerry, no idea how you stay employed. And I hear Spike, I'm now skeptical about the entire voting process because you have a vote.
Can I add 2 more notes?
Please.
On Wednesday, I saw that Brian Windhorst agreed with me and went from Kawhi to Russ. And Windhorst, to me, is probably the best journalist overall, if we're going well-rounded game in basketball. So I feel pretty validated that he's on my corner and was with Kawhi initially. And then the second thing I wanted to say is that your Paul Ryan and Chaffetz comparison really, really cut deep. And it's it led to an unbelievable amount of soul searching over the last few days.
Sorry.
So, but I've come out the other side, and I'm more secure than ever in my Westbrook vote.
People were just texting me the word Chaffetz for like 3 days after that. And like, it really did make me feel bad. But hey, look, while we're shamelessly name dropping, I got a message from Zach Lowe. He wanted to know who I voted for. And like, without like thinking about it, I just like went straight into my like case for Harden, you know, my 15,000 word case for Harden. And I was pretty convinced that I was going to be able to sway him. And then the next day he announced his vote for Kawhi. So that worked out great for me. So in terms of the shameless name dropping category, you win.
Well, to be clear, though, I don't know Brian Windhorst. We've been in the same place a bunch of times, but I mean, I've never really like spoken to him. I'm just saying
I can't go respected journalist for respected journalist in this conversation. I'm out here on an island by myself.
Yeah. All right. One more MVP question here. Joao says, how does Steph Curry's 15-16 MVP season rank amongst this year's candidates? Shout out from Portugal. This is one thing. Speaking of Westbrook hyperbole, there are a lot of people who have said, like, this is the craziest season we've ever seen, or like trying to measure this against history. It is really impressive statistically, but what Steph did last year was way better and above and beyond what we've seen from anyone this year, in my opinion.
You're too smart for your own good, Andrew. I hate it. I really feel like now that you've turned 30, you have really sensible opinions way too often. You're right. I mean, Russell Westbrook didn't even have the most impressive season in the last two seasons. Steph Curry was the unanimous MVP for a reason. It's much harder to win 73 games and be the main guy and do the types of three-point shooting that he did and to carry an offense as high as he carried it last season than what Westbrook did. And sorry, you know, I'm a Westbrook guy. I've hated on him less, like I keep reminding everyone, than you have all season long. Mm-hmm. I think it was one of the most entertaining stories. You know, I'm not even disputing any of your stuff about entertainment value and narrative and all that this year. I give it all to him. But carrying a 73 win team like Steph did deserve the unanimous MVP, and it will always sort of be recognized as a cut above many very, 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 very good seasons.
Yeah. It was unbelievable. All right, let's shift away from the MVP talk now. Good snorkeling expedition there. Greg asks, do you have any all-time favorite tanking moments? I tuned in to the last 5 minutes of Lakers-Kings Friday, and in that time, I watched Meta pull up from 5 feet beyond the arc, posters by Ben Mack and Papa G, D'Lo hitting a go-ahead three, followed by Luke Walton having a dumb blank stare like Eli Manning, and then Buddy Hield handing off the inbound to Corey Brewer on the final possession. I didn't watch Lakers-Kings Friday, but I'm really glad that I got to read that little paragraph recap there from Greg, because I can't bring myself to like I can't bring myself to actually watch these games, but I'm glad that all that is happening.
Well, on the other hand, I definitely can. I fully immerse myself in self-torture down the stretch of these seasons, time after time. Lakers-Kings was a great place to go find that kind of sadomasochism if you're interested in it. But to be honest, there were some lows that I had to sit through in Portland as they were kind of figuring their things out. And the one that jumped to mind was the end of the 2011-12 season for the Blazers when they really blew things up and had a big sell-off at the deadline, fired Nate McMillan, put in Caleb Canales as the interim coach. And I was going back through some of the box scores of games that I was stuck reporting on in person. This is their lineup. This is their lineup for one of the late season games when they were tanking. They played Nolan Smith 39 minutes. They played J.J. Hickson 38 minutes. Hasheem Thabeet started. They gave gigantic minutes off the bench to Luke Babbitt, Johnny Flynn, Kurt Thomas, and Craig Smith, the Rhino. So, I mean, they did kind of fill a little bit of time with Nicholas Batum and Wesley Matthews, who were still decent players. But that team, and that team wasn't even the team that lost 13 in a row to close the season. That was the next year's Blazers, who had Damian Lillard as a rookie. But it was basically the year where they were trying to like get in position to draft Lillard and take Myers Leonard. That was so unwatchable. And I'll never forget the press conference when they announced the trade for Thabeet and Johnny Flynn. It was the first time you've ever seen a packed house, because it's Portland, so everybody goes to all the Blazers press conferences without a single question being asked. They're like, let's just open it up. Who has questions for Hashim and Johnny? And Andrew, it was dead silent. And then they were like, okay, cool. Let's just go ahead and do one-on-ones then.
Not a lot of Thabeet interest.
No, it's like, are you guys still going to be here in 2 months? I mean, like, what's the question that you even ask in that scenario? So that was one of my favorite tanking moments. But can I go back to the Lakers just real quick? Because I need to read you one of the most depressing emails that I've ever seen in my entire life.
What?
Here's how it starts. Lakers game notes. And it's in bold, all caps, underlined. And it says four straight. And here's the email. This is from their PR department. The Lakers have won four consecutive games for the first time since closing out the 2012-13 regular season with five straight wins. Keep in mind, Andrew, they sent this email during the portion of the season in which their only mission in life was to lose. Lose, 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 lose. 4 years straight, it's the only thing the Lakers have been able to do consistently besides get into inter-family squabbles in the ownership group, right? They've only been able to do two things: Jeannie and Jim fight, and they lose basketball games on the court. They're supposed to be losing so they can keep their their pick in the draft order above Phoenix's, so that they're not going to lose it in a completely, you know, really like self-inflicted gunshot wound if that's how it goes down on draft lottery night. And now, because they're a professional basketball organization, they actually have to send out emails pretending that they're proud of this fact, even though this is the worst possible scenario. And you know Luke Walton is just taking every single one of these wins so hard because he knows it's like screwing up his own future.
Your favorite taking moment is that Lakers email then?
Yeah, it narrowly edged out. It narrowly edged out Nolan Smith, Johnny Flynn, and Thabeet. You're correct.
The Thabeet press conference sounds pretty tough to beat. The only thing that sticks out to me is the year that Durant and Odin were available. Was it Mark Madsen who just was launching threes in Minnesota?
That's a classic.
That one to me is frozen in time. But yes, the Lakers failed tanking expedition over the last 2 weeks is definitely a highlight throughout history. And maybe they'll be rewarded. I don't know. Maybe this reverses the karma of like the hostile takeover that we saw 2 months ago. Should we run Tankathon just for fun here?
We should always run Tankathon just for fun. We're milking those guys so hard. They're our bell cows.
Let's see. The Knicks at number one, Magic at number two, Sixers at number three, and wow, in this version, the Lakers fall down to number six. That's rough, but well,
perfect.
That's all right. All right, let's move on.
Well, Mason's got a question for us. He wants to know, do you and Sharp have a coldest take award? It's sort of like that account that reminds people of their past screw-ups. You know, what was your most inaccurate prediction of the season? And I actually do have one. Do you remember we got into a really big argument about DeMar DeRozan's scoring average at the start of the season? You said he was going to average, I think, what, like 37 or 35? What'd you say?
The number has gotten bigger every time you bring this up. I said he would average 30 for the year. Where is he at now?
Okay, so I guaranteed he would average under 28, okay? And I'm here to tell you, I'm looking at his box score right now. He averaged 27.3. So actually, I guess I was completely right on the money, 100% correct, as always.
Can I ask you something? Did I successfully sway you on putting him on third-team All-NBA?
No, not even close.
Okay, all right.
Not even considered.
He got half our podcast vote.
Sorry, I don't know what to tell you in terms of cold takes, but I think we've had a pretty much flawless season in terms of predictions, don't you think?
Yeah, that's right. I think we were right about everything. That's definitely the takeaway. Next question. Jonas says, least valuable player, not a bench scrub or a bad contract, has to be a starter. On this one, I mean, coming into the year, we were asked to predict the least valuable player, and we correctly nailed Derrick Rose. I think would be sort of the popular choice for least valuable. But I was thinking about it, and I think you got to go bigger. And like every American player on the Knicks could qualify for least valuable. Like if you go to, I mean, Melo is not immune in this conversation. Like he is in the mix. And then Courtney Lee, least valuable, has a decent case, is kind of just there.
You're beating around the bush, though. I mean, there's one obvious name.
Joakim Noah. Pretty rough this year. There's one person, the Knicks international scout knows what he's doing, and the rest of that organization is just a disaster. I think that is what we have learned, because Hernan Gomez is kind of good, kind of fun. Kuzminskis is pretty solid. Porzingis is okay, and everyone else just is tough.
Well, I love these least valuable questions because it just gives me an excuse to start searching on Basketball Reference to see like who produced the worst advanced stats in large amounts of time. There's some very great names this year. We got D'Angelo Russell, Reggie Jackson, our old friend Buddy Hield. Of all players who started at least 50 games, though, there's one man who had the fewest win shares this season, and his name is Matthew Dellavedova. So I didn't necessarily see that one coming before the season started. Other guys I think deserve to be in the mix is the aforementioned Solomon Hill. He had a rough year. Chandler Parsons, obviously injury related. But I would have to say Noah would be my answer, because he didn't only just kill this season. He killed the next three seasons as well. It was so obvious it was going to happen. It completely calls into question Phil Jackson's ability as a decision maker and contract giver. And if I was a Knicks fan, that's the unforgivable move out of all of them. Even jerking around Melo, even taking a shot at Derrick Rose, like you can kind of defend those decisions. Even hiring Jeff Hornacek, you can kind of understand where he was going with it. There is no defense for Noah, period. There was no defense for Noah when he signed it. It was a terrible contract from the jump, and it's only gotten worse. And by the way, he's currently suspended for violating the anti-drug program, and he's going under the knife again, reportedly. This could not have gone worse. I think he is the single least valuable player in the league.
Okay. Fair enough. I just think it's not right to single out one Nick as least valuable. They all deserve some credit there. And as far as the Delly thing, you know, your bullshit win shares do not measure grit and heart and intangibles. And I think deep down, you know it too. So he does not belong in the conversation. But all right, next question though. Austin says, who would win between the NBA's best 6'6 and under team versus the 6'10 and over team? So I put together a preliminary roster here for both these teams.
So did I. You go first.
That's awesome. I was cooking dinner and I started making it up in my head. So for the 6'10 and over team, I have Giannis at point guard, Kevin Durant at shooting guard.
No, you can't have Durant though. He's listed at 6'9".
But he's not 6'9". He's 7 feet.
We are going by Basketball Reference, period.
No, we're not. Kevin Durant is on the 6'10 team. Anyways,
all right.
My roster has Karl-Anthony Towns at small forward, Anthony Davis at power forward, and Rudy Gobert at center.
Well, you were 4 for 5. If you had more integrity as a voter, you would not take Kevin Durant, and you would take Blake Griffin in his place. That would give you the perfect 6'10 and over team, and that would give you a starting five that I picked that would absolutely murder the 6'6 and under team. No questions asked.
Okay. First of all, not to be a stickler here, but Blake Griffin is not 6'10". I don't care what he's listed at. He's 6'8".
Jesus Christ. All right, like, look. We have to go by the list heights. If we don't go by the list heights, we've got nothing in this world.
All right. Well, look. So on my 6'6 and under team, CP3 at point guard, Steph at shooting guard, Russ at small forward, Bradley Beal at power forward, and Jimmy Butler at center.
Okay, you also can't have Jimmy Butler, sorry.
That one was tricky because he's listed at 6'7", and he might actually be 6'7". So I don't know.
He's definitely 6'7". But here, you pretty much nailed it. I think you should... Did you say Harden?
No, Harden could be in there too, yeah.
So Harden should be your power forward because he actually kind of defends power forwards a lot and he's kind of bulky. And I think the best decision for the starting center on this team is actually Andre Iguodala. Just because like he's kind of physical. He's about as tall as you can get and still be 6'6 or under. And he's smart, so he's kind of crafty. Like he's not going to stop Rudy Gobert in a one-on-one matchup on the block, but it's pretty much the best defensive center you could get for the 6'6 and under team. So you're basically trying to spread everything out. You got Curry, Harden, Paul, and Iguodala. I mean, that's a lot of shooting. I still think that team's getting killed by the big guys, though. I don't see how they're keeping up.
I agree with you. And so teasing that out a little bit, I started to think about the team between 6'6 and 6'10. And that gives us LeBron at point guard, Klay Thompson at shooting guard, Kawhi at small forward, Paul George at power forward, and Draymond Green at center. So does that team beat Giannis, Durant, Kat, Anthony Davis, and Gobert?
For sure. And I think you should probably put Jimmy in there for somebody on that team. I'm not sure exactly who. He'd be on my top five for that group. And I think that team is the best. And especially if you throw Kevin Durant on that team, which is where he belongs, that team's easily the best.
I'm actually upset about this. So I'm just going to move on. We don't have to argue about the height thing anymore. But Kevin Durant is 7 feet tall. Anyways, mailbag question for awards from Tanga says, yours and Golliver's all league pass teams, most fun players to watch that aren't all NBA caliber. I'm going to give a shout out to the Phoenix Suns and Tyler Ulis, Devin Booker, TJ Warren, Marquise Chris, and Tyson Chandler. That's my league pass team.
Oh my God. Well,
I think he was asking
tell us
for
more
individual
about that hapless group.
No, I've just had a lot of fun checking in for 20 minutes of Suns games all year long. Ulis really started to come on down the stretch. And obviously Booker was doing his thing until I think he started to rest a couple games down at the end. TJ Warren, I will always believe, and really got to get into a nice little rhythm once they traded PJ Tucker. Marquise Chris can't totally figure out how real his future is, but he had some flashes. And Tyson Chandler, shout out to Tyson Chandler for still getting paid after all these years. I didn't have the energy to go around the league and come up with a bunch of different individual guys, but I did like the Suns this year.
Yeah, I mean, we have very different definitions of what's entertaining. I'm almost like hesitant to even like name these guys because I don't know. I'm just going to get mocked because everyone's going to say, oh, you're a self-parody. Like Danny Green, Andre Robertson, like guys like that who get no attention whatsoever and are really good at minor things. I mean, those are the kinds of guys I enjoy watching on League Pass if it's not the star type players, okay? But mm-hmm. We all like watching the stars. Let's not...
Well, then name your sad League Pass team.
I just named two of them and I can already hear you sighing. I don't want to name anymore. Let's just move on.
I cannot believe that you singled out Roberson as an exciting League Pass. That is... The next question is... Who is the Waiters Island hipster MVP of the year? Singling out Roberson on Russell Westbrook's team is like a super hipster move for like a really select group of NBA Twitter. So
look, you know how you always come back like 3 weeks after I say something and like, yeah, you were right about that. Just wait until like game four of this Rockets Thunder series. And he's going to be making Harden's life pretty miserable. And you're going to come back and say, man, that guy can really play. He gets after it. He can't shoot. Everybody just talks about his lack of shooting, but he's very valuable. Oklahoma City should consider giving him big money this summer, keeping him around. He's a great fit alongside Westbrook. Just wait for that. Okay. Yeah,
look, I watched Roberson last year. He's solid. He's like a linebacker out there.
So no need to make fun of me. No need to poke your finger.
Well,
in my eye.
I thought about the hipster MVP choice. And, you know, there are a lot of good candidates. First of all, the Waiters Island honorary hipster MVP. Dion Waiters had a great MVP case this year. If anything, it hurts his cause that he was so good because it began to go a little bit too mainstream. Rudy Gobert, I thought hard about making him the hipster MVP. Kawhi has actually kind of become a hipster MVP choice for the actual fucking MVP award, and might deserve it. Like, I still think if you want to be strictly technical about the MVP, Kawhi probably has the best case. Buddy Hield and the ragtag version of the Kings has some hipster appeal for next season. Let's say next season.
I would say Scal over Buddy Hield, though. I think Scal's the hipster MVP of that group.
And like, Papa Giannis could be a hipster Hall of Famer. I have not gotten a chance to watch much of him, but from what I've seen, I really like it.
You know who the hipster MVP might actually be? Thon, for saying that he's going to be an MVP in that article by Howard Beck. Like, that is a very hipster MVP move.
Yeah. I'm not sure what to make of Thon. But for me, I think it's clear, though. The hipster MVP has got to be Yusuf Nurkic.
Okay, you're right. 100% correct. I can't even argue that. I was gonna get mad and make a case for Rudy Gobert because I did nominate him for like half the awards this year. But it's 100. We did like 6 different podcasts all about Nurkic, so I think he wins in a landslide.
Yeah, we've definitely hit the Nurkic corner pretty hard. All right, a couple more questions here. Colin McCarthy says, at what point do teams begin to trade their terrible contracts from the summer of 2016 to each other? For example, wouldn't an Evan Turner for Bismack Biyombo trade kind of make some sense? Blazers get a backup center that can actually defend. The Magic get somebody who can run the offense in the second unit. Also, as a Blazers fan, should I consider Olshay a brilliant wizard for the Nurkic trade or a complete fool for every signing he made last summer besides Harkless? On that one, I definitely consider Olshay, he is in the running. I mean, the Magic are kind of in their own category, as are the Knicks and the Parsons contract is not holding up very well in Memphis, but Neil Olshay, the Nurkic trade only buys so much immunity. Like, that was an awful summer, and the Nurkic trade was kind of like fumbling in the dark, and they struck gold a little bit. But I think it's still a lot of this is on him.
Okay, I got a couple of thoughts. First, you mentioned the Magic, and I just need to point something out here real quick. So all season long, the Magic's president, Alex Martins, made a real big deal about saying essentially that they were going to make their evaluation of their front office after the season. They didn't want to, make any rush decisions, during the season as another disappointing season was unfolding. And that, of course, that's an attempt to be real classy and professional and buttoned up, right? So the email landed in my box at 7:19 a.m. this morning, which was the very day after the season ended for the Magic. So their evaluation process between their last game and the time they sent this email was roughly 9 hours. And the email is entitled in Arial Black 14 font, underlined, Magic dismissed Rob Hennigan as GM, right? So you kind of punted all of that professionalism that you were aiming for with this whole strategy of not making any decision during the season, but then making it immediately as soon as the season ended. I'm just saying it's a little questionable how they executed that. In terms of Olshay, he bought himself some real time with this Nurkic thing because they had to answer the center question. And he mentioned the possibility of Biyombo. That was something I was kind of floating out there at the trade deadline. Do you just take a gamble on him or Mahin Mee, one of these guys who got huge contracts and fills a need? I mean, clearly Nurkic is a much better alternative, especially going into next season on his contract number because it's a rookie deal, than any of the other possibilities that were out there. So it helps his life a lot. He doesn't need to unload quite as much money this summer because he's bought himself a little bit more time. If he can just trade one of Turner, Crabbe, or Myers Leonard, their cap situation of flexibility is going to be looking a lot better. So I don't know if that makes him a brilliant wizard. I definitely think that this is a team that still has a pretty hard ceiling with a core that's like Lillard, McCollum, and Nurkic. I mean, I'm not sure you're going to be much better than maybe the 5 seed in the West. Mm-hmm. But that's a lot better than the complete and utter teardown that they were headed for. And I wrote this in my end of season grades, but no offense to Miami or Washington for their huge turnarounds. Like, Portland's turnaround had the biggest impact because it potentially saved their GM's job. It potentially saved their coach's job. It potentially delayed, and maybe indefinitely delayed, a trade that would split up, you know, Lillard and McCollum. And also, if you had brought in a new GM, that guy's first moves is going to be just punting as many of these bad contracts as possible. So it potentially keeps Evan Turner in town, potentially keeps Crabbe in town. So we could have gone into a next season where the Blazers are completely overhauled, going through a crazy retooling. And instead of that, that trade basically, you know, restored everything, including their own sense of self-worth. So I don't know. I think digging yourself into that kind of hole only to pull yourself out of it is not worth any sort of an award. But that's what happened in Portland this year.
Okay, fair enough. Yeah, maybe I was too hard on him. I don't know. That summer still just was, it made no sense to me. But we should answer the actual question as we've both gotten too far off track here. Would an Evan Turner for Biombo trade make sense to you?
Yes, for the Blazers for sure. For the Magic, I don't know. I mean, I'd probably just roll with Biombo, but they got bigger problems than bringing in Evan Turner. You know, I don't see an easy solution for them.
What I wanted to highlight more than anything was your Evan Turner plus minus tweet last night. I think wasn't it? Did we start the season with you getting involved in some like Evan Turner plus minus beef?
Yeah. So 4 games into the year, Jared Sullinger popped shots at me on Twitter because I tweeted out Evan Turner's plus minus. Now, granted, it was 4 games, but I acknowledge that it was only 4 games. Clearly, the small sample size was implied. So I waited until the very minute after the season ended to provide an update. And Evan Turner finished with the worst plus minus of any player who was on a playoff team and was on that same playoff team for the entire season. Okay, Jared? That's all I'm saying.
Yeah, it put a nice little bow on things for me. All right, now, quickly, we are moving to the international section of the pod. Phil Henderson says, "Hey, Ben, I'm writing to you from Switzerland, proud to be probably the highest altitude listener of the pod as I listen to you guys while sitting on top of a mountain summit at 6,900 feet. Shout out to Phil, man. And his question was about the Lakers. We've already dealt with the Lakers. But yes, thank you for listening all the way in Switzerland. Frederick says, "You also, since you guys talked about all your Australian listeners, I wanted to know you have Norwegian listeners too." And now we move to the Nutella section of the podcast.
Oh, God.
Glenn says, "We pronounce it Nutella in the Philippines." Shout out to the Philippines. Steve says, "English podcast listener living in Finland. International listeners is definitely a thing. Nutella, though, and Prodigal, come on." So that is, I think I mispronounced Prodigal last time. I said Prodigal when I was talking about you in Portland.
Look, I don't think we need to dwell on the mispronunciations, and I don't think you owe anything to these people. Like, you don't need to include their questions when you screw something up, okay?
I enjoy it. Chris says, "Love the pod. Really makes," he's in Austin, Texas, "really makes the yard work fly by. Since pronunciation has become a theme, please remind Andrew that it's social mores." Got that one wrong too. But all of which is to say, I think we have finally settled the Nutella issue, because Alan says, "I live in Cork, Ireland, where Ferrero has a corporate head office. I've known many people who worked there. I asked them, and all company communication pronounces it Nutella. Stop the Nutella madness." And then from that tweet, I said, "Yeah, it makes sense that Americans have been getting it wrong all along." And then someone named Holger chimed in to say that in Germany, it is Nutella. And then John said, "The most American thing to do is keep on blatantly mispronouncing it just 'cause."
Can we be done with the Nutella stuff? I mean, honestly, like... the most American podcast thing to do is to run a pronunciation or mispronunciation into the ground for like 9 episodes. So I think we can lay this to bed. We were right the whole time, man. It's Nutella. We know it. The Australians know it deep down. And bottom line, even if it is Nutella, I'm not going to pronounce that. It sounds weird. It's creepy. I don't want to be on the internet saying Nutella.
I think the real takeaway here, though, is that we're ready for the playoffs. We've settled this. We've resolved it. And we've heard from a lot of people all over the world. And now we're ready to move on. You know, game one, Saturday at noon.
Okay, enough pronunciation talk. Let's close this out. The playoffs are here. We're excited. Let's make one prediction for the playoffs. You go first.
Cavs are missing the finals.
Ugh. Okay, you've already made that prediction before, but I'll let you off the hook with that. My prediction is the Warriors will win it all. Kevin Durant will not be moved to tears by it.
Okay, hold on real quick. Could the Warriors go faux? That's my not a great Daryl Dawkins impersonation there.
Okay, I love the pod. I'm here in California. It's pronounced four. No, I don't think they're going faux. That's too hard to do. I mean, I could see, I think 16-3 is a reasonable best case scenario. Like, I think that they've got at least one sweep in them. I think that some of the late game issues that we talked about earlier this season could come back to bite them. Complacency is always an issue. Draymond randomly getting suspended for something is always a possibility. So I'm going to set the over-under on them. Let's just call it 3.5 losses for the postseason. That's a really high number. I understand. I mean, like, high expectations, but these guys deserve to have high expectations. Okay. This was the fourth most dominant team ever in terms of point differential, the most dominant team since the 1996 Bulls. If these guys don't win the finals this year, it's going to be an utter disaster. Consider they won 67 games, then 73, then 67. If they only have one title to show for that run, that is a complete mess. All the pressure's on them. They're going to have to do it. And I think they're going to go, best case scenario, 16-3.
Okay. I just, it's not completely out of the question with this Warriors team, just because there aren't a whole lot of teams in the field that look like they can challenge them. I mean, like, you're not going to talk me into, Houston could steal a couple games if they get that far. But, and the Spurs maybe won. I don't know. It's on the table is all I'm saying. Like, there's probably a 5-10% chance. And more than anything, the way I think about it is if they get to the finals and Cleveland makes it to the finals, the Warriors are going to want to sweep them and really send a message.
Yeah. The only thing that could be the undoing in that scenario is KD's mind games against LeBron. You know, like, LeBron might have that hex on him, and the home court advantage is pretty good in Cleveland. So I'd be hesitant to pick a sweep in that matchup. But yeah, I hear what you're saying. It's not inconceivable because we haven't seen the Warriors at their best yet. We agree about that, right? Like, they were kind of cruising for most of the season. Then it kind of went sideways with KD coming out, like, with the injury. Now they're putting the pieces back together. They're going to be fully motivated now that Damian Lillard predicted the Blazers were going to win in six games.
Did he really do that?
Yeah, he did that. And it's funny because, like, so this week on Wednesday, I dropped my iPhone and just shattered the face of it. And it was just one of those moments where you're just like, God, I wish I had these 10 seconds of my life back because this was such a crucial mistake. And I could see the exact same look in Lillard's eye as he was on camera during this interview when he was asked, you know, are the Blazers going to win in six or seven? And he just kind of, like, sheepishly said Blazers in six, but then everybody ran with it because, you know, it's kind of Brandon Jennings part two.
Yeah.
So he had the same regret as I did for dropping my phone. And unfortunately, I was able to get my phone fixed very quickly. I don't think there's going to be any fixing of his mistake. I think Golden State is going to punish him for it.
Yeah, well, it is what it is. The magic begins on Saturday. We will talk to you guys next Tuesday. And thank you for listening if you've made it this far in the podcast.
Openfloormail@gmail.com. Send us all your questions. Thanks so much, Andrew. Hey, 5-star reviews. I'll talk to you next week.
All right, man. Take it easy.
This has been a digital media production. Find your voice.
Another great edition of Open Floor is in the books. Did you know Locked On has a daily podcast for all 30 NBA teams? If you're a Lakers fan, search Locked On Lakers. A Celtics fan, search Locked On Celtics. Warriors fans, search Locked On Warriors. Yes, all 30 NBA teams have a daily bite-sized podcast on the Locked On Podcast Network. Search on Apple Podcasts or Google Podcasts for Locked On, your favorite team. Or tell your smart speaker to play podcast Locked On, your favorite team.
It's the Locked On Podcast Network, your team every day.